Spirit Catholic Radio, KVSS. We are Catholic Radio for the Christian community. Good morning. Welcome to Spirit Mornings with Bruce McGregor and
Chris McGregor.
And Chris, today we have with us Mark Brumley. He's the president of the Board of Directors of Guadalupe Associates and Chief Executive Officer for Ignatius Press. He also oversees magazines for Ignatius Press, is project coordinator for the Ignatius Catholic Study Bible, and the editor of Ignatius Press's Modern Apologetics Library. He is the associate publisher of IgnatiusInsight.com, residing in Napa, California with his wife and five wonderful children. Mark, it's really a pleasure to have you here with us this morning and all the great work that Ignatius does. Welcome.
Well, it's great to be with you. Long distance.
Yes.
Yeah, quite the long distance. But for many of our listeners, though, they're used to hearing your voice, Mark, on Catholic Answers.
Yeah, I'm on there pretty often.
Yes, you are. And we're just very excited to have you on the Spirit Morning Show now for this morning audience, primarily because Ignatius Press has developed some of the best material, gone out after the best authors, and have provided Catholics throughout the world, but in particular in America, the opportunity to learn and grow in their faith. And praise God for all the work you do.
Oh, thank you. It's a real blessing to be able to be involved with something like Ignatius Press.
When you talk about your illustrious list of authors, of course, number one on that, I hope you don't mind by saying Pope Benedict the 16th.
Don't mind at all.
Oh.
We're so pleased to be the primary English language publisher of the Pope.
He is remarkable, isn't he, Mark? I mean, even in his writings as Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, he is a theologian who really does theology on his knees.
Great way of putting it. So often there aren't so often theologians don't do theology on their knees, and he's an example of someone who does, who prays his theology.
And I'm very thankful for Ignatius Press because I don't think I ever would have appreciated just what a gift we have in Pope Benedict the 16th if I hadn't had the opportunity to actually read his work. It ranges from a man who is a pastor writing, you know, from his homilies to very deep theological tomes, but so much has been said about him by other people that the only really good way to know him is to read him, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You really come away with the man's range, as you mentioned, you know, everything from homilies to theological writings of some substance that would probably have made Joseph Ratzinger, you know, a notable figure in the history of the Church, even if he hadn't been elected Pope. So I really encourage people not to simply look at the headlines in the newspaper, but to read what he actually has written.
And many of the commentators and writers at Ignatius Press can help break that open. I'm thinking in particular of Father James Schall and Carl Olson and yourself.
Right, yes, we do. We do try to comment on the books that Ignatius Press publishes, including the works of the Holy Father. We do that a lot on our blog, IgnatiusInsight.com. And, you know, we have interviews with authors and all kinds of things like that. It's good to have context for what you read, and especially with respect to the Holy Father. Oftentimes, I mention the newspapers and the headlines and things of that sort. Oftentimes, what the Pope is saying gets taken out of context or put into a certain spin is put on it, and it's really, really important for everyone, Catholics and non-Catholics alike, but especially for Catholics, take the time to read what the Holy Father actually says.
I think he's an extraordinary Christian apologist in the truest sense of the word, don't you think, Mark?
Yeah, you know, that's probably something that most people don't associate with the Pope. They tend to think of him as a pastor, even the chief pastor of the Church on earth, but they don't always recognize that part of what he does is to explain and defend the faith, to answer questions or objections that people have to the faith, and he often does it in an indirect way. He doesn't trumpet that he's about to engage in apologetics, but he does. You know, the Holy Father's recent encyclical in talking about hope isn't just a pious reflection on the theological virtue of hope. It does reflect on it from that perspective, but it's also a powerful apologetic for the truth of the Christian faith. If we really want hope, our hope, the Holy Father says, must be rooted in something, something real. And there's nothing more real and more powerful and no firmer foundation for hope than God himself. And so that's part of what the Holy Father says in his encyclical, and it's an argument that he makes that I think has a certain apologetical weight to it.
You know, when you speak of apologetics, I think, Mark, 20 years ago, we were thinking of apologetics as Catholics defending their faith, trying to understand where we can find what we do in Scripture and our ability right. to be able to communicate that. But it really has evolved into something much deeper, hasn't it?
Yes. It's really, it's a fascinating thing to see. I certainly, there's nothing wrong, and in fact, there's much to commend the practice of trying to show how, you know, the Catholic faith can be found in the Scripture. Some Catholics tend to think the Bible is Protestant terrain, but in fact, you know, it was the Catholic Church that received the Bible and canonized the Scriptures and so on. So we shouldn't think of the Bible as off limits for Catholics. At the same time, you know, apologetics is much broader, and it really does try to show that that the act of believing is reasonable. It answers questions people have. I often say that apologetics is sort of the flip side of evangelization. You evangelize by proclaiming the gospel, the good news about Jesus Christ and God's love for mankind and all of that. And then in the process of proclaiming that message, questions arise. You know, how can God love me if, you know, there's so much evil in the world? Or, you know, how can Jesus be the only way when there are so many other religions and so many other truth claims out there? Can we know that there's a God? Can we know that there's a purpose? How do we reconcile claims about God and creation of the human person with dignity and inherent value and purpose with claims about the evolution of the human race and things of that sort? So naturally enough, as you proclaim the gospel message, there are questions that arise, and apologetics tries to give answers, help people understand what the Catholic faith has to say about the human situation and human existence and the purpose of human existence.
Mm-hmm. And that really has come into light in a very compelling way, I think, in the last few years with a rise of the atheist authors, that gang of guys who are out there trying to tell us that God is a delusion and that everything that we hold dear and sacred is really just something that is a crutch for us. And we really need to have Protestants and Catholics need to come together and unite in that shared witness for Jesus Christ.
Absolutely. You're right to call attention to the rise of what's called the new atheism. I don't think it's really new. The only thing that's new about it is the aggressiveness with which its proponents present their message and the greater sympathy that seems to exist in the mass media in order to, you know, in terms of being a conduit for that message. Mm-hmm. But it's really the old message of atheism, and while there's a certain kind of what I would consider adolescent pleasure that can be taken in being rebellious and going against the consensus of human existence, the vast majority of human beings believe in God and that sort of thing. Ultimately, it really isn't satisfying. It really is a kind of a nihilistic way of looking at the world. And the Holy Father, in his recent encyclical and in many of his other writings, calls attention to the fact that if there's no real purpose to human existence, and of course the new atheists deny that there is a purpose, there's really no real purpose that human beings discover. It's not meaningful to talk about human beings creating their own purpose, because what that means is there really are no objective values of truth and goodness and beauty that we can conform our lives to. Then really, what's the point of it all? Is there a point to it? And it's very difficult for the new atheists to answer that in an honest and direct way. The perennial message of Christianity, and again, as you rightly underscore, the message of Catholics and Protestants and Orthodox Christians all share, the message of Christianity is that we were made by God for a purpose, and our purpose involves coming to know him, and in coming to know him, We are united with one another, and it's a life of truth, of goodness, of beauty, and one of victory over the evils of the world. It gives us hope that in the end, the true and the good and the beautiful will triumph.
Well, I think when we talk about the new atheism, you think that mindset would have been at least put aside, understood, and discredited anyway, given the events of what atheism did in the 20th century. And yet, here we have it rising again. And I think when we talk about God, and we talk in particular for us, for Jesus Christ, who is God made manifest for us, the ground really got tilled and the soil made fertile for this new atheism, I think probably 15 years, maybe 20 years ago, when the historical Jesus, can I say fad, started coming into play, where people were just ripping the scriptures apart, dissecting them, and then just leaving them there. And consequently, it ended up affecting the certainty of the faithful in the belief in scripture.
I think that's true. I think we should make a distinction between sort of the logical foundations for the new atheism and what I'll call the psychological foundations. The, the logical foundations are probably rooted in the Enlightenment of the 18th century and the materialism of the 19th century and the scientism of the early 20th century. This idea that anything that's knowable is knowable by science, and if science can't know it, doesn't exist. That was part of the new atheism. Another part of the new atheism was the sort of, the desire for moral relativism, which became very popular in the middle and late part of the 20th century. If there is no God, I can do whatever I want. Since I want to do whatever I want, that makes me conducive to the idea that there's no God. I think these are sort of the logical foundations for it. But then there's a kind of a psychological foundation, the way that the greater mass of people get affected by the idea. And I think that this attack on the traditional understanding of Jesus is part of that psychological cause. If, you know, the Western society is really founded on Christianity, and certainly traditional ideas about who Jesus is and why Jesus came and things of that sort. If you attack that in the popular mind, or you create doubt about that in the popular mind, if you create doubt that the Jesus that everybody has come to know through the church, even people who aren't regular churchgoers, have traditionally held what the church says about Jesus, if you create a doubt about that, then people are disoriented, and they're much more inclined to say, well, you know, we've always thought that Jesus was the Son of God, and that he came and taught these things, and the early church picked up on them, and whatever we think about institutionalized religion, we believe these things about Jesus. But once those things go, then it's sort of all things are up, you know, everything's up for grabs. And so I think psychologically, the foundation has been laid for this new atheism by this radical skepticism about the traditional understanding of Jesus.
It's so wonderful the work that Ignatius Press has done, and in particular through all different types of medium, to help us, dare I say, recapture what we've known as a church, but we haven't been educated in, and primarily, to be more precise, the fact that Gospels, like the Lost Gospels that are portrayed in the DVD that is so exceptionally well done by you and by so many of the scholars that you have on there, are really false Gospels that have been brought forward. I mean, this is the time of season, Mark, when people are going to be at home flipping on the channels on these educational and historical channels on cable, and they're going to see all kinds of documentaries that are going to lift up these Gospels like somehow that they are authentic and are worthy of our consideration.
Yeah, that's a problem. It just seems like every other month or so, certainly during the Christmas season and usually around the Easter season, the major news magazines come out with some kind of story or special supplement or something of that sort, that these things usually tout the idea that everything you ever thought about Jesus is really wrong. And you've been told a certain thing about the canonical Gospels, that is to say the Gospels of the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Well, whatever you've been told about those Gospels is really wrong, and we've got these other writings that really tell us about the real Jesus and so on. And to some extent, you can explain this as, you know, the way the mass media often operate, you know, they try to debunk and things of that sort. But I also think that it's fed by a kind of radical cultural skepticism and a desire to, liberate, as they would say, liberate contemporary culture from these traditional Christian ideas. You know, sometimes we think, oh, well, you know, I'm going to go to Mass, and I'm just going to be a good Catholic, or I'm going to say my prayers, I'm going to keep to my family, do my family activity, and all these ideas that you hear out there, they really don't have any impact on me, you know? Mm-hmm. Those are for the deep thinkers and people like that, and I really just don't need to pay attention to those kind of things. Well, the problem with that is that those ideas, wrong-headed ideas, about Jesus and about Christianity, they come back to affect us and to affect our culture. And we find, if we're not very attentive to things like this, that pretty soon there's an assault on our children. We've had this controversy about the Golden Compass book by Philip Pullman and the series of books, you know, the Golden Compass has been made in this film. Mm-hmm. And this is really atheism for children. I mean, it's a series of books that are aimed at debunking Christianity. The author of the series has said as much. I mean, he's not been bashful about saying that, although most recently sort of backpedaled on that a little bit when the film came out. Mm-hmm. But where did all this come from? Well, it came from this, you know, the universe of ideas and these radical ideas that are opposed to Christianity. So you're right with respect to Jesus and the Gospels. This is very, very potent when it comes to our culture. And one of the things we wanted to do with Lost Gospels or False Gospels is really bring together Catholics and Protestants to look at this question and show how the traditional Gospels of the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, stand up very well against the so-called Lost Gospels. And in fact, these Lost Gospels really don't tell us much about the real Jesus. And they're really not historically reliable.
I'm struck by something I had heard while watching the Lost Gospels, False Gospels. It is, again, so well done. It can rival anything that's produced on any major cable network or network programming. But one of the things that was said was that in the Lost Gospels, the Gnostic Gospels, that they would flip what we would understand as Old Testament understandings of characters like Cain.
Right.
Or that somehow those things that we saw as evil and has fallen or committed wrongs, that you would actually flip them and they actually were just misunderstood.
Right.
And they were actually a good and not an evil. And it seems to me as though even they were doing this 2,000 years ago in these writings, that's even happening in Philip Pullman, because he takes and flips.
Right.
And tries to lift up things that we know are harmful and evil and flip it and try to make them into the good. I mean, it continues on, doesn't it?
Yeah, there is a connection. You know, the Lost Gospels were, for the most part, Gnostic in origin. Gnosticism was a second century movement that posited a radical opposition between the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New Testament. The God of the Old Testament was the evil creator God. The God of the New Testament was a spiritual, distant being, and the Gnostic idea was that Jesus came to liberate us from this material world by giving us wisdom and special knowledge, and those of us who were in the elite had the special knowledge. Gnostic comes from the Greek word gnosis, which means knowledge, had the special knowledge, could transcend the limitations of material world. Well, Pullman doesn't accept that spiritual dimension. He is actually a materialist, an atheist, and so he rejects the idea that the material world is bad, but he keeps that radical idea of knowledge and special knowledge, and he flips it, he flips the flipping of it, and makes the material world good, and anything that in any way challenges your your experience of sensuality or your own ideas about truth, you know, as if there's an objective truth out there or an objective morality that can put constraints on our physical impulses or our ideas about the world. He sees that as evil, and of course, traditional Christianity has a lot to say about those sorts of things. So he does. He takes the story of Genesis and the temptation of Eve by the serpent, and he uses that, and he reverses it, and he says, actually, the serpent is the good figure, and God is the bad figure, and he's trying to keep Adam and Eve from knowledge, especially knowledge of the sensual, and this has been the cause of many difficulties. The church is bad and evil because the church purports to have knowledge of the truth and talks about the dangers of temptation and sin and so on, and this is just a way of controlling people and taking the souls out of little children and that kind of thing. And so all of this is there in Pullman, but it has its roots in Gnostic ideas that Pullman has sort of manipulated for propaganda purposes in his children's literature. And these Gnostic ideas are found in the so-called Lost Gospels.
Yeah, the thing about the Lost Gospels is that, it, like Pullman, we can examine them and realize, well, they're garbage for us. They're not good spiritual food. And so we put them away. We get rid of them. We do not include them canonically. We do not bring them into the worship as the early church did. And yet here we are 2,000 years later, you have so-called scholars and authorities who appear on these television shows telling you that somehow these streams of Christianity are valid.
Right, right. The two things there. First, what is the validity of the claims that these gospels and these writings represent lost Christianities or alternate views of Jesus that are historically valid? There's that. And then there's the second question of, well, what's the agenda in doing that? And I think the answer to the second question is pretty straightforward. It's to delegitimize Christianity, delegitimize Christian culture, delegitimize traditional Christian values, values that have to do with God and the human person and right and wrong and the purpose of life and so on. If you delegitimize those things, you can pretty much say and do what you want. And since modern people have this desire for radical autonomy, the freedom to do whatever they want, however they want to do it, without reference to, you know, moral norms directing them to the good and things of that sort. If you can discredit Christianity, you go a long way towards getting what you want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's what you do so well in the Lost Gospels, Mark, because it not only gives you the historical understanding of where these writings come from, why they were not valued by the Christian community, but also why we did form the canon. I think that's something that a lot of people don't understand. I mean, we're quick to accept, well, Constantine came in and he just forced the universal church to accept certain writings. And yet, as you point out in the Lost Gospels, the DVD, there was a much more chronicled undertaking that occurred in the life of the church with these scriptures.
Yeah, long before. First of all, we should put some things in historical context. Jesus died and rose from the dead around the year 30. Most of the Gospels, well, we'll say the four Gospels that we know, the Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, were written sometime between the year 60 and the year 90. You get scholars who will disagree about this or that, but somewhere 60 to 90, 95, John's Gospel is usually considered to be the latest, somewhere in the late 90s, that time frame. So we're talking about the Gospels being written within 30, 40, 50, 60 years of the time that they depict, the times that they depict. The so-called Lost Gospels or the Gnostic Gospels, they don't come on the scene until really the middle of the second century, so about the year 150. There's some debate about the so-called Gospel of Thomas. A tiny minority of scholars want to date the Gospel of Thomas to before the time of our canonical Gospels, but the vast majority of scholars say, no, it's early 2nd century at the earliest, probably mid-2nd century, and most of these writings come than 100, 120, sometimes 200 years after the time of Jesus. So that puts things in historical context in comparison to our canonical Gospels. But the thing that also has to be understood with respect to our Gospels is our Gospels represent the teachings of the apostles and other eyewitnesses who were teaching about Jesus and passing on the sayings of Jesus and the deeds of Jesus from the year 30 until the canonical Gospels were written. So although they were written 30, 40, 50 years later, they reflect the teaching of the apostles and other eyewitnesses to the events that they describe. The so-called lost Gospels do not do any of that. They are not based upon eyewitness testimony. They are not based upon early teachings that were verified by eyewitnesses and that were widely circulated and widely known in the community of Christians, many of whom had actually heard Jesus for themselves. But these so-called lost Gospels or Gnostic Gospels reflect ideas developed by people who came many, 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 many years after the apostles, most of these writings draw on the New Testament Gospels, even when they disagree with them, when they try to rewrite history, when they try to make Jesus into a Gnostic, they do so by using the New Testament Gospels. So there really is no historical credibility for these writings. They do not stand up to historical scrutiny, and we have no real objective historical reason for thinking they tell us anything about Jesus that we don't already know from the canonical Gospels and from the other writings of the New Testament. And when they differ from those writings, we have every reason to think that this represents misinformation and a distortion of the real Jesus, the Jesus of history.
Mm-hmm. And the thing is, I think one of the reasons why the false Gospels in our time, in this generation, have risen to the fore again is because it can be presented in a medium like television in an hour program. And, you know, you have the lighting and the staging and how they film it. So it almost seems, just for the average Joe Pew person,
right,
this must be authentic. Look what they've done. And they don't know how to question that. And that's the beauty of Ignatius Press, because you have gone in there, and this is not a dry DVD chalkboard type of thing. I mean, this, you've gone in there and taken the best elements, got some of the best scholars in the country, I mean, both Protestant and Catholics, and have produced something that visually can help people understand a very potentially confusing topic.
Yep, I think that was what we tried to do.
You did it really well.
Yeah, we wanted something that would be engaging and informative and would be, you know, sort of competitive with the other things that you're seeing out there that don't give the full story. And, you know, the idea for this documentary came about when I was teaching a New Testament class for Catholics in the Archdiocese of San Francisco. And I had Catholics who are saying, well, what about the Gospel of Judas, and what about the Gospel of Mary Magdalene? You know, some of them had read the Da Vinci Code, and they'd heard all these things about, oh, how Constantine did all of these things, so they had questions. And these were church-going Catholics now. These weren't, mm-hmm. you know, people out there who had no faith or were unchurched. And I thought, well, gee, if church-going Catholics can be confused about this, it's really important that we get our side of the story out so that people know what the full picture is and not just the side that you often see in the popular media. So that was the genesis behind this. And, of course, we wanted to bring in top-notch biblical scholars, and we wanted to do this in a way that was very engaging, just like the things that you see on the Discovery Channel and the Learning Channel and all these other things.
Yeah. And the thing I think, too, Mark, is that, you know, part of this is the fact that you do have these very prominent or kind of marquee names, you know, that we've all heard throughout time. I mean, we've heard of Peter, Thomas, right, Mary Magdalene, Judas, James, Andrew. And in hearing that, I mean, it almost causes people, it's like, boy, you know, maybe these do have some credibility.
Yeah, absolutely. That's part of the attraction. Of course, wouldn't we want to know more about Jesus? Of course we would. and somebody comes along and says, well, we have this information from the, you know, from Peter and James and from all these other apostles. It's this information that didn't make it into the New Testament. And, of course, we live in a time when institutions, especially religious institutions like the church, are called into question, their authority and so on. So the idea that, well, maybe there were these secret writings that the church kept from the people and hid and so on, that's very appealing to some people. They buy into it because it plays into their kind of anti-establishment mindset. Mm-hmm. And so when someone comes along and touts a message depicting this, you know, people are susceptible to it. But we go through and we show how there were very good historical grounds for why the church picked the books of the New Testament that it picked. This was not an arbitrary decision. It was not a decision to bolster the authority of the apostles. I find that idea comical that, well, you know, the apostles picked the gospels that they did, and their church picked the gospels that it did because it bolstered the authority of the apostles. Well, anybody who's taken the time to read the canonical gospels of the New Testament knows that the apostles come off looking pretty bad,
yeah, mm-hmm. yep.
for the most part.
Yep.
Now, if all of this was contrived by them to put themselves in power in the church, why would they do that?
Right, right.
Why would they deliberately show themselves not understanding what Jesus meant, you know, and betraying Jesus and not being courageous and so on and so forth, if this was all a power play? And, of course, if you know, why would they do that? We raise this question with respect to the resurrection. Sometimes people say, well, the resurrection of Jesus, you know, that was all made up by the apostles so that they could start this new religion. Well, would you really make up such a thing about Jesus, given the fact that he had just been crucified by a combination of the religious authorities of the day and the political authorities of the day? Would you really want to start a new religion and go out in the face of that opposition and start proclaiming that Jesus rose from the dead in order to get what? You're not going to get power and authority. You're going to get the same thing that happened to Jesus. And in fact, that's exactly what happened to the apostles. They had no reason to think that anything different was going to happen to them. And in fact, the apostles wound up being martyred for their proclamation of the message of Jesus. So this idea that this was all a cleverly constructed power grab by the early Christians just doesn't hold up to the weight of the historical evidence.
Yeah,
and I think that's so comforting to people who seek out products by Ignatius Press, Mark, because it's solid, it's true, it makes sense, it helps you, you know, to exercise your brain and to really think about things and to offer an alternative to what the culture is trying to cram down our throat. And you know that you can sit down with other family members who may be skeptical and just pop this in.
Yeah.
And to watch it, along with so many of the other products that you have, like the Footprints of God series with Stephen Ray. I mean, those are just fantastic.
You know, you mentioned something that I like to talk about, because people say, well, you know, I can't be an apologist. I just don't have the time to study all of these things. And I think sometimes we exaggerate the obstacles to becoming an apologist and study and so on. But even so, I think it's true to say that most people don't have a lot of time to devote to becoming experts in all aspects of the faith and being able to answer any question or any objection. And the wonderful thing about books and very powerful thing about videos is you don't have to be an expert. You can always give a book or, as you said, sit down and watch a video with someone who is saying, well, you know, what about these Gospels? Well, just sit down with them and watch the video and talk about it later on.
Mm-hmm.
It's a powerful way to evangelize and to respond to questions and objections that people may have.
Mm-hmm. And on a quick other note, I just want to say thank you, thank you, thank you for bringing these beautiful films that depict the lives of the saints.
Yes.
Beginning, you know, even with the two Bernadette films and Francis and Padre Pio, I mean, I think they're the best example of what Christianity is about, because they've shown us in their lives how to live it.
Well, we're really trying to do that. We're trying to get very good films on the lives of the saints. You know, not cheesy things, mm-hmm. but, you know, very good dramas, well-scripted, well-acted, that kind of thing. and get those out to people because they are very powerful. They are very moving. And I have to say that Tony Ryan, our marketing director, he's just been, it's been phenomenal how he's been able to find these films and make them available and get the distribution and get the rights to them. He's just done such a superb job it's a wonderful gift, I think, to people to be able to see these things and to have a top-notch film on Padre Pio or St. Francis or St. Anthony that can really inspire and move people.
Yeah, and then as well, you know, it's wonderful that Ignatius makes these available to parishes and helps in, you know, fundraising efforts and everything. I mean, hats off to you and everyone there at Ignatius, Mark, for the incredible work you're doing. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you mentioned Ignatius Night at the Movies because there are listeners who have parishes who would like to be involved. They can contact us and go to our website or call Ignatius Press and be happy to have an Ignatius Night at the Movies at your parish.
Yep, they are wonderful. Been visiting with Mark Brumley this morning, Chief Executive Officer for Ignatius Press. And Mark, before we wrap up, any final thoughts or maybe a tantalizing morsel or two that's in the hopper here at Ignatius coming out soon?
Well, I would say a couple things. One, keep an eye out. We're going to come out with a deluxe hardcover special edition of the Holy Father's encyclical on hope.
All right.
Oh, wonderful.
Keep an eye out for that in early 2008. And right now we have a book called The Pied Piper of Atheism, which is a refutation of Philip Pullman's Golden Compass and his Dark Materials trilogy. And people who are interested in finding out more about that can go to the website, www.atheismforchildren.com. The book is written by Pete Vreary and Sandra Meisel with an introduction by Carl Olson. It's just a superb and very enlightening refutation of Pullman that parents need to know about. Because oftentimes these books are in their schools, public school, even in some Catholic schools.
Mm-hmm.
It's important for parents to be, you know, to have the ammunition to be able to deal effectively with this. And lastly, I want to mention people that are interested in the Lost Gospels or False Gospels DVD can go to a special website that we've designed for it, which is called falsegospels.com, and you can actually see clips of the documentary there.
Wow.
And you can find out more information about it.
Yeah.
Well, we'll certainly have a link to that on our website. And you mentioned Pied Piper of Atheism. We've had the feisty Sandra Meisel on with us.
Isn't she?
Oh, she's fantastic.
She's wonderful. It's a good thing she's so unopinionated.
Yeah, really.
And you know, the neat thing about Sandra is she really is an expert in this area. She's written fantasy novels herself,
mm-hmm.
and she's known some of the great fantasy and science fiction writers of the 20th century. So this is not somebody who's just sort of, you know, I don't like fantasy, and you know, I don't know anything about it, and boy, this terrible Philip Pullman guy is out there. No, she knows the subject very, very well, and she's sympathetic to fantasy, and she also, that gives her a lot of credibility in analyzing, you know, Pullman and what he's doing.
Right.
Yeah, she doesn't suffer fools very well.
No.
You know. But, Mark, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you on with us, and just a blessing. And we just, you've touched so many people in so many ways, they don't even realize it.
I'm just thankful to be able to work for Ignatius Press with Father Fessio and the other great people at the press. And it's just a wonderful opportunity to serve God through getting the word out.
Yeah. Well, Mark, and we really appreciate the relationship we have with Ignatius here and, you know, all the wonderful materials and stuff we've had for Carathons. I mean, this is just a great way to get things out to people.
And the authors you brought us.
Yeah.
I mean, oh,
phenomenal.
Wow. Our audience has been richly blessed and filled with so much more assurity about their faith because of Ignatius.
Well, and we do that because we believe in the mission of Catholic Radio, and we really want people to support Catholic Radio. It's important that they do. It's an opportunity, certainly, for those of us who are knowledgeable Catholics to grow in our faith, but also for other people who don't know anything about the faith to be evangelized. And I know you guys probably have lots of stories about people who are maybe falling away from the church or were unchurched altogether and, you know, happened upon your station and were, you know, brought back to full communion with the church or come to know God or whatever. And this is a powerful and very important mission and important means of carrying out the church's mission today. So that's why we support what you're doing.
Well, we're praying really hard for the fledgling Catholic radio station in San Francisco.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, it's just out of the gate, and we're excited about it. thanks. Keep us in your prayers, and we'll continue to try to work together on that.
Absolutely. Mark Brumley, everyone. Mark, we appreciate it again. Thanks, and God bless.
Take care.